For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Late last week, a grand jury released its investigation findings for the State Department of Health, which declared financial insolvency last year, resulting in the layoffs of nearly 200 people. Turns out, not so much. Apparently, the agency was never insolvent, but rather a victim of what is described as reprehensible and inept practices, but nothing actually illegal. Neva, what do you make of these findings?
I think reprehensible is not too strong a word. There probably need to be stronger words. The mismanagement, the deception, the slush fund, the $40 million slush fund. I mean, the list goes on and on. And this grand jury investigation, I mean, what is really unfortunate is that there were no criminal charges that could be brought forward. I mean, the ineptness and just the travesty that went on, not only for the agency, but for the services that were impacted by it. So I think this really sets the stage that lawmakers are going to have to stop talking about figuring out what's going on in these agencies with respect to how much money is there and how it's being spent, but really getting down into the weeds of these programs and figuring out that they can't just come in and gloss over and say one thing. I mean, in this instance, I mean, they were doing things for years and years and years, and there were a lot of people that it was on their watch. So I think this is just one of those really black eyes that we need to learn from, and we need to not let happen again.
Ryan.
Well, and how did this happen, and how did it go on for so long? You know, Neva talks about how lawmakers need to step in and make sure that this doesn't happen. One of the findings of the grand jury was that we can no longer entrust volunteers, essentially, that serve on these commissions, you know, these unpaid volunteers that are supposed to provide an oversight role to these agencies. We need to professionalize these things, and we need to make sure that controls, accounting controls, are in place in these agencies. It has a political black eye. I mean, I think that, you know, there's this narrative in Oklahoma that we don't need to increase revenue, that it's simply just a matter of increasing efficiencies and eliminating waste and corruption in government. I think that this is an exception. I really, really believe that. But it's certainly going to further that narrative, and it's going to give ammunition to the people at the Capitol that just want to cut agencies. One of the real, if there's a bright spot out of this, it's that we had some heroes here. Chief financial officer, the chief operating officer, and other numerous people within the health department that came forward at their own risk to report this and to bring this to the light. These are the bureaucrats, you know, that we use bureaucrat in a pejorative way a lot of the time, but these are the career state employees who stepped up and said, enough is enough, and we're going to bring this to the light. And Steve Lewis, former Speaker of the House, wrote an op-ed who said maybe we need greater whistleblower protections so that these career agency employees feel more comfortable to step forward when they see this kind of mismanagement.
Neva.
Well, and I think the whistleblower aspect is one thing. I think just creating an environment with these people that are selected to be the top heads of these agencies, there really has to be not only the qualifications and the professionalism, but there has to be the integrity and the track record that they are going to be someone that has the respect and also has the ability to set the culture and the tone within the agency. I mean, there's a lot that has to be done now that we've seen what's come about as a result of this grand jury investigation. There has to be a whole new mindset as well as a whole new operational style, not only at the health department, but across all of these major agencies and state government. And we hope that this is the only black eye. But frankly, there's been speculation rampant through the past session that there are other agencies that we may see big headlines and stories similar to this before it's all said and done.
One of the recommendations from the grand jury was to take some of this money that's sitting in these reserve funds or slush fund at the Department of Health and use that not only for performance reviews within the state, within the Department of Health, but within other agencies as well. And I think, you know, Neva, when we talk about decision making, there was clear breakdown in the decision making process. The interim director, Preston Dorflinger, whenever he came in after these allegations first came to light, the additional $30 million in supplemental funding that was appropriated by the legislature, the cuts to almost 200 people's jobs, which had dramatic impacts on state services that the health department was providing, those were made, and now in light of this grand jury, before all the facts were in. And so they were just these haphazard, like, we feel like we've got to do something, so we're going to fire 200 people, we're going to ask for $30 million. And that was before the facts were in. I know that I feel like everybody, we can give some benefit of the doubt to the people here that they wanted to do the right thing. But if you're doing the, if you're just wanting to do the right thing, but doing it without the relevant information, you end up in situations like this.
Challenges are growing to State Question 799 to end tax increases to fund pay raises for teachers, support staff, and state workers. Groups are also calling for boycotts of businesses which allow the petitions at their workplaces. While all of this is interesting, a report from Oklahoma City's News 9 appears to show the group Oklahoma Taxpayers Unite is simply dropping off the petitions to proprietors to let people come by and sign. Ryan, would this call into question the signatures the group will eventually get?
Absolutely. It's sloppy at best, and potentially illegal. We have very strict laws in the state of Oklahoma to protect the integrity of the initiative process so that the people that are collecting those signatures are witnessing the signatures, are verifying that these people are qualified voters in the state of Oklahoma, that they're eligible to sign these. And what we're seeing is they're just dropping them off, or at least the reports are, is that they're just dropping them off at businesses, sometimes left by the cash register, and people can sign them, you know, willy-nilly, or they'll hand them out whenever they ask for them. It's amateur hour. You would think for an organization that's run by a United States senator, or at least has a United States senator as their lead spokesperson, that they'd have a little bit more professionalism here, but this is just amateur hour. And in addition, from the way they're collecting signatures, which I think is going to be a huge problem when they start to count those, but the petition itself, the referendum itself, was very shoddily written, and it looks like maybe a lawyer didn't even look at it, because I think the challenges filed by OEA, APOE, and the others that are challenging this as part of a coalition, I think that they stand a good chance of prevailing at the state Supreme Court later this summer.
And even, it's not just Coburn, but I mean, a lot of people who are listed on the Oklahoma Taxpayers Unite are bigwigs in politics and
well,
especially and conservative politics.
And I think oftentimes what you have in these kind of processes is you hand it off to a group that you assume has the expertise and the understanding to follow what are very, as Ryan said, very specific guidelines as to how these signatures have to be gathered, what has to take place, ultimately how those documents have to be notarized and attested to and prepared to be submitted to the Secretary of State's office. So, I mean, the idea that you can just do it willy-nilly, the idea that there that kind of no rules apply or whatever the mindset is there, I think has really clearly jeopardized the entire signature gathering process from the get-go, and whether they get the 41,000 or 51,000 or whatever number, I do think that's clearly going to be, I think, challengeable, I think we would expect. And then the legal issues that Ryan raises, right. I mean, those are ones that I think most people in the legal community, regardless of their bent on the issue itself, would say they have some real serious problems on that issue as well.
Earlier this week, Tulsa Public School Board voted to close schools on November 6th of this year, allowing for teachers and support staff the day off to go vote on Election Day. Tulsa is joining Oklahoma City and UConn Public Schools in closing for Election Day. Neva, could this have an impact on turnout?
I don't know that it has an impact on turnout. Frankly, I think it's going to be interesting to see what the backlash or the reaction to it is among the public in these individual communities when they really start to think about what this means and what's taking place. Now, across the country, in 2016, we saw a lot of school districts. I remember, hearing about many instances in many of the larger school districts across America where, because of safety concerns, because in some instances, 75% of polling locations in large areas like Cook County or other areas in the Atlanta area, wherever you look at, were in schools that they had some real issues that were safety-related that caused them to close the school that day or take other measures. This is something totally different. I mean, we have an opportunity. We've had elections, since statehood. People have an opportunity to do absentee voting. They have early voting. They have voting on the day of the election from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. So I really question the need for these teachers to feel like that they have to be have a day off and go out on street corners or whatever they want to do to express their political point of view when they can take the day off to do that if they felt that strongly.
Right. Well, if they take the day off, they have to pay for it.
That's right.
My wife's a teacher.
But if they feel that strongly, maybe that's something they should consider.
I think there's a practical and a symbolic effect. The practical effect is that a lot of these teachers are at the school at or before 7 a.m. in the morning. I mean, that's that they're
wife
there.
Is, yes.
And to get there, and then whenever they're done, it's not like, you know, my son's class, you know, they're out at 4, and they've been out at 5 because they had to extend the hours because of the walkout. But they get out at 4. Well, the teachers don't just go home at 4. And so, you know, and they've also got, you know, so that has a very small window of time for them to get to the polls. And then I think the symbolic effect is that it's just reminding these teachers that this is an election day, that they are important players in the political process, and let's use this as a moment of symbolism to get them into the polls. Now, if we really want to increase turnout in the state of Oklahoma, it's going to take a lot more than a couple of resolutions by school boards, even in the largest districts in the state of Oklahoma. Absentee balloting, use this. Go on the state election board website, sign up for your absentee ballot, get it in the mail. Even if you decide not to use it, you can still show up in person, but you have that option. Go sign up for it. It's an incredibly effective way to make sure that you're notified of elections. And then I think the legislature needs to step up to the plate, and we need to look at things like mail-in ballots, you know, not just absentee, but actual mail ballots. Same-day registration, online registration, extending the voting period for a couple of weeks, things like instant runoff so that we don't have as many elections. There are a lot of things that we can do to increase voter turnout, but those have to be done at the state legislative level.
And while it's not about necessarily teachers, but parents are also going to go, well, why are my kids home? Well, it's election day. Maybe it'll remind them they also need to go out and vote as well.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of that symbolism, you know, is just as an impetus to folks that this is political season, this is an important day, and even for those students. I can remember some of my earliest memories as a kid were going to vote with my mom, and the first time I went, I thought that she said we're going to a boat, and we got to the Presbyterian Church in Seminole. I thought, this is not a boat, but those early days, and I think, you know, giving parents and students and teachers an opportunity to talk about elections and the political process is going to help.
And I think, but let's remember, I mean, whether it's but public safety personnel, whether it's a hospital, you know, workers, whether it's people at a university. I mean, you can name any setting in the world, let alone, you know, just the business, you know, the folks that go to work in a business or a home business, whatever it happens to be. I mean, there are more folks that we're talking about being involved in this election process than just the education community, and I think that's getting lost a little bit in this discussion.
Last week, we talked about a few of the bills Governor Fallon had signed and vetoed, but one veto, which flew slightly under the radar, was actually a pretty big deal. Fallon says no to Senate Bill 1212, which would have allowed judges rather than jury sentence a juvenile to life in prison without parole. Ryan, this controversial bill was getting criticism from both sides.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this was a bill that it happened in the last few weeks of session. It was an enormous bill. It was a huge change to the juvenile justice system in the state of Oklahoma, a huge change to one of the most powerful or the most powerful punishment allowed under the United States Constitution for minors in any state. So the Supreme Court has said that you can't execute a minor or somebody who committed a crime while they were a minor. So the last remaining most powerful punishment is to sentence someone to life without parole in prison. They're there until they die. And whenever you think about that, I visited with somebody just yesterday who had a life without parole sentence that was recently commuted. And one of the things that she talked about was whenever you have these sentences, you're not eligible for a lot of the programming in prison because they say you're in too long. You don't benefit from any of this. So you're just thrown away in a cell to die. That's an extraordinary punishment, and one that's so bad that every other developed nation in the world has abandoned it, and around 20 to 30 states have since banned the practice altogether. That's where the state of Oklahoma really ought to head. The Supreme Court has signaled that only in the most exceptional cases, and maybe even cases that they can't even contemplate, that this would be allowable under the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution. I think that that's where we're headed. I think Governor Fallon was right to veto this bill. It was not a serious consideration of a huge problem facing the state of Oklahoma.
And it really hadn't gone through the process, Neva. It had just been thrown on the floor. It hadn't gone through all committees. It was just amended and thrown out there. So
Right. Maybe
something like this, if it goes through the process, maybe it can be amended and changed and fixed. But
maybe at least there will be the opportunity for the real discussion and the give and take and the debate, which is necessary on something that is this serious. I mean, Ryan is absolutely right. I mean, we can't look at anything, I think, in terms of legislation that could be any more significant or any more long-term, far-reaching than this particular bill was. And I applaud the governor for being what I think was a courageous vote. I mean, to veto this measure when, you know, many you know, we're certainly pressing her to do the contrary.
And she stood up to one of the most powerful lobbying groups at the state capitol, the district attorneys and the District Attorneys Association. They're the ones who managed to get, really, there are very few lobbying groups that can manage to get a bill this comprehensive, this detailed, passed in the final weeks of a session where everything else they were trying to wrap up, but they managed to get this through. That shows how powerful the lobbying effort is at the Capitol and how much deference legislators give to district attorneys and prosecutors, and the governor stood up to them, so good job for her.
And again, I mentioned the fact that it didn't go through the full process. Would there have been any kind of a legal challenge? I know that they don't have to deal when it's no open records, though. I mean, they're not really responsible for that. But because it didn't go through the process of a committees, and would that matter at all?
Courts give a tremendous amount of deference to the legislature and the processes that they're going to use to pass legislation, so long as the legislation complies with the constitutional requirements.
Which both sides have to vote for.
The number of readings that have to happen in both chambers, and the number of votes that have to happen, and has to pass in identical language in both chambers before it's presented to the governor. As long as it complies with those constitutional requirements, courts are going to say that those are political questions, and if you don't like the way the legislature is doing that, you go and you vote out those legislators. That's your remedy if you don't like the way they're handling the process at the state capitol.
An outspoken Tulsa Republican senator wants a special session to reverse all of Governor Fallon's vetoes over the past 7 years of her administration. Senator Nathan Dom is working at getting signatures from lawmakers to call them back into session over the summer. Dom says Fallon has issued 133 vetoes over her two terms in office. Neva, is this feasible or just political grandstanding?
I think it's political grandstanding. And let's face it, the two folks that we're talking about are both in Republican primaries.
Representative Sean Roberts, I didn't mention that. And
that's certainly, I mean, whether they say it factors into the equation or not, you have to certainly wonder, I mean, on the surface. But, I mean, I think this is, again, one of these attempts to kind of throw something out there and create this sensation and really, in some measure, I think confuse people about what you're even talking about, if they even follow it at all. So it's kind of the inside baseball that splinters and I think causes some consternation and differences of opinion among lawmakers themselves. But certainly, I can't see any traction to this particular effort at all, but it does get them some headlines.
And I do actually have to say it was a really slow news day. There was very little going. Yeah. And we picked a really good day to do it.
Well, Senator Dom is kind of like Candidate Dom. It's like Bruce Banner and the Hulk, right? So here he's Candidate Dom and just in full on green political rage. I mean, this is where he's at. And I think that Neva's right. This is political grandstanding. Even Senator Dom or Candidate Dom has said, you know, it's questionable whether or not they can even overturn the vetoes. Maybe we have to show up at this special session and introduce new legislation.
Which they would have to do.
And then the governor would probably veto it again. So that would make it all for naught. That's just kind of where we're at. If you don't like that process, again, if you think that those bills were vetoed and they shouldn't have been, bring it back next year or fight for it to come back next year. And then if it's vetoed again, then you go through the normal override process while the legislature is in session.
And the thought that you're going to look at the 133 vetoes that the governor's done during her time in office, first of all, that seems somewhat preposterous. And secondly, if it's all just an attempt to kind of reinvigorate this debate on the, quote, constitutional carry measure that they were both deeply involved in, that's a whole nother set of issues. So I think it's much to do about nothing probably in terms of a special session, but it probably did accomplish what they set out to do, and it got them some airtime and some discussion just out there in the public forum.
They're gonna look like Second Amendment champions. They get that on their mail piece. They're gonna be able to knock on the doors and say, "This is what I'm doing to fighting for guns and gun owners." And really, we started off our conversation today talking about the need for greater oversight in state agencies. One of the things that happens at the Capitol is that we get caught up on these political issues that are really just fodder for campaigns. And the legislators don't really have an opportunity to spend the time necessary with these agency heads, and not just the agency heads, but the career employees at those state agencies, to learn where the nuts and bolts are, where the bodies are buried, and make really good decisions about state government. Because we spend so much time on stuff like this, and this special session almost assuredly will not happen. But if it does, it will be a monumental waste of time.
There you go. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.